This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Robert H. Dumas, City Librarian at the Decatur Public Library, where we're recording on February 13th, 1986. Well, Mr. Dumas, this year is a kind of anniversary for this oral history project. When I came to Decatur 10 years ago, one of the very first things I did was to ask if you could use help in oral history, and I was delighted when you agreed. And this is the 64th program of the series, and it has really been a pleasure to work with you.
Well, I want you to know, Ms. Turnell, that I've been delighted with you and the project that you've had, and I think that over the years, in the future, that this may turn out to be one of the more important things that we've done here in Decatur in the last 10 years.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, because I really enjoyed meeting all these people and hearing these stories. Yeah. It's been a great deal of fun. Well, this year, however, also brings us a feeling of sadness, because you have told us that you are going to leave the library after 20 years of service.
Well, I figured that it's about time that I got out of here, just ahead of the posse in the tar and feather crowd. Now, I've always felt that I never wanted to retire, ever. You know, I thought a few years ago that I might want to someday work part-time. And, but I've gotten very tired in the last year or so, and The library's changing, and the whole library world is undergoing a kind of a renewal at the present time. And new things need to be done in the library that require a new perspective or new expertise. And I think that, I think the board would like to work on this. And it seems to me that any new projects or plans should be drawn up by somebody who's going to implement them. And so I thought, well, this would be an opportune time for me to depart.
Well, I understand all that. And of course, you may not actually retire. You'll always do something, I'm sure, some project or some position, even if it isn't library work.
Oh, I'm sure. And even a different kind of library work would be something that the thing that brought me into library work in the first place was working with collections and people. And for the last 25 years or more, I've had very little contact with the public and very little, comparatively small contact with the collections, so I try every day to get out and work amongst the collections some, a little bit. But the major part of my day is spent in an office reading reports and writing memoranda and shuffling paper one kind or another. And it's really administration has its rewards. I don't mean to say that it doesn't, but it's really not the sort of thing, the kind of attractions that lured me into library work in the first place.
Well, let's talk about your life before you came to Decatur, maybe even telling us about your childhood.
Well, my childhood was fairly unexceptional. I grew up in a small town. I may be one of the last generations that can say they grew up in a small town, and in the state of Maine, in northern Maine, where the winters are extremely long and very harsh. And it's kind of a remote area that I grew up in. It was a sort of a frontier community in many ways, as I suppose most places in Alaska now are frontier. The community was only, at the closest point, 6 miles from the province of New Brunswick in Canada. And the lines of communication, I think, were greater between Canada and Presque Isle, Maine, where I was, than between southern Maine and Presque Isle. The Aroostook County in which Presque Isle is located is called the county in the state of Maine. It's the largest county there, and every once in a while, facetiously, I guess, for the most part, people will talk about seceding from the state of Maine and creating its own its own state because it's people feel neglected and isolated, and they feel unappreciated by the rest of the state of Maine because of this isolation. When I first joined the Army, I was joking. I had my basic training with the Tennessee National Guard, and I was sort of joking with the people from Tennessee there. They had a small knowledge of the ways of the North. Most of those people were from eastern Tennessee in the hills and mountains of that state, and had little knowledge of the North and of winter. And the first I went into the Army in September, and winter came on very rapidly. We had our basic training in Massachusetts at Fort Devens, and I was joking with the people without, you know, a straight face, telling them about the difficulties in getting into northern Maine in the winter time. And I described in some detail how I went about it. I could take the train up to Bangor and take a bus from Bangor to Mackwahawk. But from Mackwahawk to Holton, up through the dreadful Haynesville woods, we had to take a dog team, I told them. And I described in some detail how a dog team was hitched up to the dogs, to the harness, and both the lead dog and all that. I didn't know a thing about this, of course, but I extemporized the best of my ability, and they swallowed all of it because they could believe anything about the horrors of Maine, really. And at the end of the basic, it was getting close to Christmas, and so my leave would start on a Monday, and I wanted to leave the camp on a Friday night to go, and so I went to see the company commander, who was the brother-in-law of my platoon sergeant. And I guess National Guard units are very, they're very closely knit. And so I went to ask if I could get off on Friday instead of Monday. And as soon as I asked him, he says, "Oh yes, you're the one who has trouble getting home through the northern woods, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." So he says, "Sure, you can go." That was a dreadful lie, but I enjoyed it so much. So my childhood really, though, was unexceptional. We'd as a boy, I did the things that all boys do. You know, we'd build rafts in the spring, and unbeknownst to our parents, and float down the Presque Isle stream towards the Aroostookippa on the floodwaters, and we'd go skating in the winter time, on the Presque Isle stream, as well as there was also ice rinks in town. And out at Quaggy Joe, there was a little toboggan run and a bobsled run. And a friend of mine just up the street, an older boy, had a bobsled, and we'd go out there occasionally and bobsled. So it was, in many ways, a kind of a typical childhood. I swore because it was so cold. Winter would set in around November. I remember skating up to the rapids on the stream one Thanksgiving. That's 7 miles upstream, and the river was already frozen over enough to allow us to skate on it. I also broke through the ice up there where the rapids were, and the ice was thinner. Got my feet all wet. The sorts of things that we did were for the most part, the sorts of things that boys do in small towns where they have to make their own entertainment.
Mm-hmm. What about your schooling?
I went to the public schools of Presque Isle. I lived right across the street from the grammar school that I attended. It was a Gouldsville school. I told people that it was a Gouldville. I'd sing the school song Gouldville, not Gould, but Ghoul. But I lived right across the street from the Gouldville school, and I still managed to be late for school a good part of the time. I was in despair of the teachers, I guess. And when I was in high school, I had about a mile and a quarter to walk, and there was no salt on the roads or anything. The ice pack would be a foot or a foot and a half thick during the winter time. and the air would be very dry, and you'd walk along in that sub-zero weather with a wind blowing in from the north. It was just desperately cold, and the ice and snow under your feet would creak and squeak as you walked along, and it would just make you that much colder to hear the squeaking. And I always said that as soon as I could get out of school, I was going to go away, and I would never live where it was cold again. And here I am.
After your schooling in Presque Isle, did you went to high school there?
I went to high school there, and then I went to the University of Maine in Orono. And then after I graduated, I returned for graduate study at the University of Illinois, during which time I also taught a couple of courses there, because I wasn't intended to do, but right at the start of the semester, one of the faculty one of the English faculty had passed away from a cancer of the liver, and they had no one to take his place, so the remaining faculty shored up, and some of the lower level courses, well, a couple of the lower level courses that he had, they hired me to teach. And so that was a welcome source of revenue also. And then I spent the year following that working on my thesis, which was on Hemingway. And then I was went into the Army. I was drafted into the Army. I had visions of going to Europe, and so I had been rejected all the previous call-ups. And I was getting near an age where this was the last opportunity that they would have to draft me. And I cooperated with them by memorizing the eye chart, which because I decided I'd like to have the Army pay my way to Europe. Well, they sent me to Korea. I wasn't even really aware that there was anything going on over there at that time, but they managed to ship me over there, where I was an infantryman on the lines for a year or so, except a brief period when there was the supply sergeant for the company rotated, and I was put into the into his job for a while. And then I was back online. When I went back online, by this time things were wound down, and there was very little action after that. For the first few months that I was there, for 6 months or so, there was more action than I really enjoyed. After the Army, then I came out and went to the graduate school at Boston University with an idea of getting my doctorate. And I was living on the backside of Beacon Hill in a kind of a bohemian section of Boston at that time, and enjoying myself tremendously, as you can imagine a country boy from Maine would be in that kind of a milieu. I was going over to the Boston University had been relocated shortly before, a few years, in the post-war years, World War II, out on Commonwealth Avenue. And it was just a brief jaunt across the fens to Boston Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And I would go to the museum once or twice a week sometimes, in the afternoon or between classes or something. And on my way over to the museum, I would pass on the Fenway at the Simmons College School of Library Science. And I frequently wondered, as I went by that, what on earth they taught in a school of library science, what kind of courses. And eventually, after thinking about this innumerable times as I went by the school, I thought I'd go in and get one of their catalogs. And so I did. I went in to get one of their catalogs, and the lady who I asked wouldn't just give me a catalog. She said she wanted me to, well, just a moment, she says, I'll call Mr. Boudreau. And Mr. Boudreau was a member of the faculty who was taking over for the director of the school at that time, because he was on out of town or something. Anyhow, by the time I'd left the office after talking with Mr. Boudreau, I was enrolled in Simmons College School of Library Science the following term, and I never did know what happened. But it was a most fortuitous thing, very lucky that I fell into something that was so peculiarly suited to my temperament and background, and I've been very lucky ever since.
Well, good. Well, after you graduated from Simmons Library School, then what?
I went to Baltimore to join the Enoch Pratt Free Library staff on the advice of one of my faculty advisor at Simmons. Awfully good advice. He said he told me to change my job for the first 3 or 4 years, every couple of years, every 5 years, something of that sort. He said, change until you learn the business. He said, you've learned something here, but you're a long ways from being a librarian. And so he said, you've got to, what's going to convert you into a librarian and make you know something is a variety of experience. So try to get some variety. So I went to Pratt Library with an adult branch assistant, and after about a year, I guess it was, I became a young adult assistant in the branch, and I was trained first in adult services by Marion Hawes, who had a national reputation in adult education, and then in young adult work by Margaret Edwards, who was one of the saltiest, most forthright, clear-headed people I've ever known in my life, one of the truly genuine great librarians, I think, of my time. And no nonsense about Margaret Edwards. And she put me into a course of training, and I stayed with that for another year and a half, I guess. And then I left the Pratt Library, and I spent a year as a general reference librarian in a regional branch in Los Angeles. And then I went as a to Dallas, where I had an opportunity, just an excellent opportunity, which would come to a person of my limited experience only once in a lifetime, of becoming the coordinator of young adult services for the Dallas Public Library, one of the major libraries of our country, which were just beginning to awaken after a long period of dormancy. The young adult program was just about a year old. So I had the opportunity really to shape that program. And I stayed there for 5 years, and I'm very proud to say that at the end of that 5 years, the program had an international reputation. Our publications were distributed all over the world. It was a very gratifying thing to my ego, you understand. I don't mean that I... It was professionally gratifying also, but mainly it was a great ego trip by the time I left there. It was extraordinarily hard work, working 12 hours, 13 hours a day, and working on Saturdays and frequently going in on Sundays because we were tremendously understaffed. But the fact that we were doing things that other major libraries in Detroit and San Francisco could not begin to touch was sort of a fuel that I couldn't, it kept me afire all the time. Then I went to the, mainly because I was in somewhat of a huff, I must confess. I left the Dallas Library. My father had a heart attack in the meantime, and I hadn't been home for a great deal of time, and I wanted 3 weeks. I had a 2 week vacation, and the standard for professional librarians throughout the country has always been 4 weeks of vacation. And I asked for an extra week without pay, And I was told, after due time, that the city personnel office would not approve it, even though I'd been working enormously long hours that I never charged the library for. So I left in due course. And my next position was, and this is something that I had intended to do in the long run anyway, was to to leave the specialized services and to go into a more general field. So I became the head librarian in Dedham, Massachusetts, which was a small library, community of 25,000. And I selected that to learn the ropes of general administration. It was a small enough library so that I could handle it, I felt, and yet it was large enough to give me the necessary experience at a variety of administrative tasks. And after 4 years there, I came to Decatur.
Well, great. Yeah. Fine. And we've been delighted to have you here. When you arrived in Decatur, what kind of city did you find?
It's very odd. Ms. Tarnell, I must say that I was not taken with the city. I have to admit that. It's gotten to be home to me in the last 20 years. But I'd received a call. I don't know where my name was ever gotten, but I received a letter, really, from Art Sappington, who was president of the library board at that time. I don't know where he got my name, because I wasn't particularly looking for work. I had told some friends of mine that I was ready to make a move, but anyhow, I got this letter, and I talked it over with my wife, and she said, well, she didn't really care to live in the Midwest, and I said, I know, I don't care to live in the Midwest either. We were so happy in New England. Well, naturally, that was my home. Why my wife was happy there, I don't know, because she's from Southern California. But I decided to come out and look into the job anyway, because it seemed like a good opportunity professionally. And so I arrived on the scene, and I got up, I come in, I had a most unfortunate experience with Ozark Airlines. They had oversold the flight when I got into Chicago, and so I wasn't able to catch my regular flight. To greet me when I came, and they'd arranged a meeting, a conference with City Council that I wasn't going to be able to. And anyway, I got another flight into Springfield, and Art Sappington drove over and picked me up. And when I got up the next morning and came out of the hotel, the Ambassador, and looked up the street, it looked like an empty city. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it has to do with the breadth of the streets in Decatur. And they were all empty. It was early in the morning when I got up. And in the far distance, you could almost see the northern horizon as you looked north on Main Street there. And I was impressed with the desolate lookingness. There wasn't any trees or plantings like there is now. And later that morning, I met with the search committee, which is Art Sappington and Bob Groney, who was on the board and had been formerly the mayor of Decatur, and Bill Olson, and we sat around in the coffee shop and discussed the meeting. And I went over to see the library, and on my way over, I picked up a newspaper, and the library had had monopolized the headlines, great big black letters, library fails audit, or something to that effect. And so anyhow, I looked over the library, and it seemed very small and crowded, and how crowded it was, I didn't realize on that first cursory look. I saw Mr. Sappington later, and he said, I guess you've seen the paper, and he told him that, yes, indeed, I had seen the paper. And he said, well, that's one of the problems that are facing us. There'd been a good deal of financial problems the previous year, apparently, or earlier in that year, and the library had gone on abbreviated hours, and it had to furlough much of its staff, and there's enormous problems. So at any rate, I was so impressed by the search committee, who were so upfront and so seemed so knowledgeable to me, and had such a firm idea of what should be done, a program laid out, that I went back and I told Barbara that I thought, well, you know, I think we ought to go. And she says, well, she says, whatever you want. I says, well, you know, it's close to Detroit and close to Chicago, and there'll be things that we can do. So we haven't really gone to Detroit or Chicago very much in the past 20 years, but it seemed like a good idea then, and so we came. And we've been very comfortable in Decatur. I must say that I was impressed from the very start with the friendliness of the people in Decatur, and it really didn't take a long time for roots to start going down.
Were you in the same building that we were in when they...
No, at that time the library was located in a Carnegie building on North Main Street, on the right next to where the First Federal Savings and Loan was. It was on the corner of the El Dorado and North Main. And it was a large sandstone building. Looked substantial, oh Lord, but it looked substantial. But when I began work, I found that there were probably, in the basement, there was one room that was crowded nearly to the ceiling and over half filled with books in boxes and dead storage that there was no room on the shelf for. And there was an enormous amount of problems. It was taking up to 6 and 8 weeks for a person to register and receive a library card. And the reason for this is that there was over a 2-year backlog in registration work. There was an enormous backlog of books unprocessed in the catalog department. There was only 4 or 5 people in technical services to handle the work. There was a cataloging chief, cataloging clerk. There was no cataloger. She had been furloughed and taking another job, and there was a couple of people in the book processing unit, one of whom never came back to work. She'd take a return, but she was still on furlough at that time. And there was a clerk typist who was responsible, Mrs. Vogler, responsible for typing all the cards for all the catalogs in the library. And one person in the order department to order all the books. Well, they got the books ordered, but nobody knew what was on order because they had them all automated. They used a bookkeeping machine to prepare the orders. They typed them all out and sent them to data processing. The data processing would print them up on IBM cards and then run them through the bookkeeping machine and print out an order. And so they had all of these order sheets, as they call them, pages of paper that had the lists of books ordered on them, but there was no alphabetical list of everything on order. So one of the first things I did was to do away with the data processing link in the order work and establish a card file. And then the card file gave us control over the items were on order. That for the same book 2 or 3 times. And because another problem existed, there was no official catalog of the library's holding in technical services. So the cataloger wouldn't know what was already in or how a book had been treated previously. And so we might get a second copy of a book, and if they didn't remember getting it, they could catalog it and then enter it in a different way or classify it with a different number. We had 3 editions of Grantley Dick Reed's book on childbirth in the library at that time. 3 different editions, and every one of them had a different class number, and one of them was entered under Reed, and one under Dick Reed. Dick Reed being the correct entry. It's a double surname. So that there was, and the problems of this sort were just, there was just many instances of it. The catalog was completely unreliable for this reason. So we got the order forms going, and I established that each department would keep an order file in addition to the one kept in the order department, and that every time a book would come in that they had ordered, they would have to compare it to make sure that the right number of copies were coming, and if a book didn't come in after a certain length of time, that they could ask about it. So then when it came in, they put it in an orders return file, and they would have a little guide to what was in the library until the cards got into the public catalog 3 weeks later or so. So they were able to give better service. But the main problem that I had was to reduce that backlog in order in circulation work, and to see that people could get library cards when they came in. So we rewrote the entire circulation routines and simplified them. There used to be so many different files, and because there were so many different files, what had happened over the years, there was an overdue file. And then there was a delinquent file after 3 weeks when a bill was sent. And then there was a messenger file, because we had a messenger who would used to go around trying to get the books back from people. And because of so many files to maintain, they would get behind, and then they would create new files waiting to be filed into the proper files. And those would get out of... So they had files upon files of things that were sorted, waiting to be refiled, and waiting in a new file, waiting to be refiled into the main files. And that was what took the time while they searched to see if a person was eligible for a card by checking all the delinquency files. So we did away with the messenger. He wasn't collecting anything anyway. And we reduced the number of files to just an overdue file, period. And then we filed those cards behind the registration file. Once a person had gone delinquent, we just put the thing down there, and he could never get a card again if we come in, unless he paid his fines. And if he didn't pay any fines, then we arranged with the Decatur Credit Bureau to receive our delinquent accounts instead of having a messenger trying to collect them. So we made a number of changes, and then we simplified the routines themselves to allow cards to be issued, and simplified the form. So anyhow, in less than a year, we had gone from 2 months down to giving a card when a person came in the door, which is a very grateful thing for many people. And the number of complaints in those days, Miss Turnell. In those days, the library was on a circulation period where the books circulated for 4 weeks, but were really all due on one day, on Thursday. So you had anywhere from 4 weeks to 4 weeks and 6 days to read a book. And then they all came in. Well, naturally, on a Thursday, that meant that was the busiest day in the library. We had enormous peaks and valleys of service that the staffs, there would be... that kind of peak and valley of service you simply can't contend with. But there was no way to get around it, given the circulation system that we had, which the Roger Fry circulation study said was the most expensive and inefficient system in the United States. Quite a distinction. So we weren't able to do anything about that, because we had to change the circulation system would have required enormous initial expenses that I couldn't see where we were going to recoup, cost them out over any reasonable length of time. So we were forced to keep that system. But every Thursday we would mail out enormous numbers of overdue notices. I mean, on a Friday, we would start in preparing them. Now we had one person, this is another problem, we had one person in the library circulation department that could type. If she was absent, ill, on vacation, taking a holiday, no work requiring typing could go forth. And that was another thing that was a bottleneck. So we rewrote all the job descriptions and reorganized the staff in the library, and we required typing of all the clerical staff. And at the same time, we were able to upgrade the salaries very considerably. I made a deal with the board that I would keep a close haul on the number of positions if they would pay a competitive salary. And indeed, I had told them before I would come that unless the library would improve radically its salary scales, I could not take the job because I couldn't run the library by myself. And the board did. Very soon in that first year, I rewrote new job descriptions, reorganized the staff, and then on the basis of that the board did begin a program of increasing staffs, in some cases as much as 25% to make them competitive nationally. And that meant then that we could hire good people too, not only hire good people, but before we weren't really hiring anybody. Professional librarians were very hard to get in those days, and so on our salary scale, we simply could not hire people very easily at all. So there was a great staff shortage, and frequently the type of people who applied left a good deal to be desired, I think. So we were able to be very competitive after that with our professional staff. And shortly thereafter, they raised the salary scales of the assistants and then of the clerical staff, and the whole thing was ratified by a personnel company in Chicago that was hired by the city of Decatur. So things went along very well there, and we were able to get good people in the library, and with the necessary skills. I think that was very important. But as I was saying, the overdues would go out, the books would be due, and then the overdues would be prepared, and they would go out, say, on a Monday or Tuesday. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, the phones would ring off the hooks with people saying, I brought that book back. And indeed, in many cases, they had, but the circulation routines were such that we just lost control. So by rewriting the circulation routines and simplifying them and doing away with all of these enormous files upon files that had accumulated, we were able to bring the number of telephone calls down to what would certainly be normal, and that is maybe get two or three calls when the overdues go out. And that's roughly what we're getting now, so that it's been an improvement right along. Now, one of the problems, I think that since those times, there's been a lot of changes in the library, improvements, I would regard them. And many of them have been they've been across the line in technical services, the introduction of a catalog that would allow us, a work catalog, as I indicated, a key to our holdings that would allow consistent cataloging has been developed. The card catalog has been completely refiled because of the inconsistencies in filing and misfilings that were in it had rendered it largely, it was just terribly inaccurate. You couldn't find things in the public catalog in the old days. And so we've made a number of changes of that sort. But the biggest changes have been resulting, I think, in those areas that are obvious to the public, have been from the transition into this new building. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the old building's problems and how they were ameliorated by moving into this building. In the old building, we had a building that was originally constructed in 1903 with a Carnegie donation, and it was architecturally it was in the Greek Revival style and sculpted out of out of sandstone, and it gave the impression of massive dignity and massive structural solidity. But in fact, that sandstone was primarily just a curtain, just a veneer, and the building was not as substantial as it appeared superficially. In the 1950s, it was enlarged slightly at the rear in order to accommodate a young adult section when the young adult movement was just getting started in libraries. And later on, there was a major problem with termites in the 50s, which required considerable shoring up of the library after the termites had been destroyed. And this shoring up resulted in creating new obstacles and reducing the general usability of the area because of the columns that were required to prop up the building. In a year after I came, or 2 years, I realized that there was a great need to add more periodical literature to the library's collections, and there was no room to shelve it, so I ordered some shelving, and I was going to put the shelf. I came in once Sunday to put the shelving up in a section of the reading room where the magazines were located. And I had the shelves halfway constructed when the floor shifted underneath me, gave a slight drop. And it scared the living bedevil out of me. And I immediately dismantled what I had put together and put the stuff back into the basement. And then I roped off that reading area so that people were not allowed in the area for the remainder of the time we spent in that building. I noticed on the second floor where my office was, across from my office, was a children's room. And the children's room, I don't know when, but it was visibly depressed in the center. There had been a subsidence of the floor in the children's room, a noticeable subsidence of the floor in the children's room at some time, maybe as a result of the termite damage. And I wound up frequently wondering what floor my office was going to be on at the end of the day. The building was in an extremely dilapidated condition, and I was working. One of the things that the board had asked me to work on when I came here as part of their project was a new library building, and so I'd been working on this ever since, and this gave added urgency, if you will, to my need to forge ahead on this. And at that time, there was some vacant buildings downtown, and I was asked by the board whether they'd be suitable, and I investigated and found out that they would not indeed be suitable. One of them was the old Montgomery Ward building that later was occupied by a furniture store, Schwartz's downtown, and before that, it had been offered by a department store, Myers. But I had looked into these things, and it was unsuitable. We'd worked with the city planning staff to find some other location, and had been largely unsuccessful, though we had projected a location at the southern end of Water Street and in the area just south of Wood. We thought those buildings, if torn down, might provide a very good suitable location for the library. But about this time, Art Sappington asked me what I thought about the Sears building, which had been recently vacated. And I told him I didn't know, but I thought it was well worth the investigation. So we had an architectural firm look into this, the weight-bearing ability of the floors in the Sears building, and we concluded that indeed it would meet the requirements for a library. And Mr. Sappington wrote to the Sears Roebuck Company to see if they could accommodate us in some way, make a gift of the building. Well, they couldn't make an outright gift, but they did give us very good terms. And so we went to the city council and asked their blessing on the project. And we received it because it was such a great bargain. The building was such a great bargain. And then, in addition, we received a sum of money from the federal grant program, the Public Library Construction Service and Construction Act grant, of about $300,000, so that the building and the cost of remodeling amounted to something like $1,300,000, which was considerably less than it would have cost to remodel and upgrade and expand the building in which we were then in. It would have been, the costs of that were set somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 or $2.25 million. So this was a cheaper alternate to expanding that building and would have been far more satisfactory. So we concluded to do this. A separate corporation was set up to buy the building, since we couldn't go to a bond issue on that. There wasn't time. And a separate corporation was set up to buy the building and to lease the building to the library. The library's long-term lease for the building furnished collateral by which the corporation, the private corporation, was able to borrow money from the banks, consortium of local banks, in order to erect and do the, to remodel and fix the building up for the public library. And then afterwards, we later issued, the time was available, we had a bond issue on a referendum, and the citizens approved it, which allowed us to get underneath a heavier debt burden to a much lighter interest rate. So it all worked out financially very well. Now, in making the move, it took close to a year for the financial paperwork to be done and the contractors engaged and for them to let subcontracts and for the entire thing to be done and to sell the old building, which was sold to First Federal Savings and Loan. Then came the day of moving. At long last, we had projected moving from in November and announced it, and then had to change our minds December, and we'd change our minds because moving a collection of, I think it was something like 212 or 213,000 volumes at that time, is a daunting prospect, really. And we developed a plan after a good deal of thought and about how we were going to do it. We decided we would close down the library for 3 weeks. And then during that 3 weeks, make the move. It was proposed that we invite everybody to take out as many books as they could and then to return them to the new library. We decided against this, however, simply because the prospect of reshelving those books when we would expect a large influx of business as a result of moving would just be enormously difficult and something we could not contend with. So what we finally did is we hired a moving company, and then we went around and we marked every shelf in the library with a number on some masking tape. And then we had these books loaded into boxes, and then we took the masking tape that was on the shelf with a number on it and put it on the box. In the meantime, we had come into the new library and we had marked every shelf with a number. And so that all we had to do when we got here was to take the boxes of books with the numbers and to bring them to the area where the shelf with the appropriate number was listed. So the movers were there. They would load the boxes. The boxes were put into the trucks. The trucks driven over to the library and and they brought down to the area that was listed. We had a large sequence of numbers to guide the boxes, 1 through 500 on this floor in this area, and 501 through 703 at this area, and so on. And then the entire staff was responsible for unloading the boxes and for loading the shelves. And the catalog department was busy. We had greatly expanded our public catalog, and there was another, there were three times as many cabinets now. So the all of the boxes, the old cabinets were emptied of their shelves, and the shelves were brought over and then redistributed to the new cabinets, and the new cabinets had already been made up and subdivided alphabetically so that the old cabinets, the old shelves, were emptied into the new in accordance with this previously derived scheme. And it did take just about the 3 weeks. We planned very well on the time scale there, so that we were able to accomplish, and then we opened the new building. Now, what we did, Miss Turnell, was go from a building of 20,000 square feet, which was really closer to maybe 16,000 usable square feet, to a building that had 60,000 square feet of usable space. And we made the transition that had more service desks, of course, to serve the larger area. And we made the transition with no increase in staff. I wondered how we were ever going to manage, quite frankly. And the fact that we were able to manage is nothing but a credit to the staff for shouldering an enormous burden, because there was a 1,001 things to do that first year we were in there. Our service program was able to take off and was greatly augmented, and the staff was able to cover more service points and address a much larger service program, and all because they were able to subsidize the library in many ways by doing a lot of work at home that would normally have been done here at the library. So the people of Decatur owe a great debt to the staff for this, for the way in which they met the challenge and overcame it. We were unable to have any public programming in the old building. We had one program, the Books Between Bites program, sponsored by the Friends, which was started in 1965. And I should here give a great pat on the back to the Friends of the Library, because for several years prior to my coming, they had been actively lobbying for a new library and preparing the community for the need for a new library. Well, they had the only program that was being offered in the library in the old building. And when we moved into this new building, we greatly augmented the program with story hours and with staff book reviews and with an enlarged program of book discussion groups. And we would start having things like Christmas in September, where various organizations, women's organizations, would bring in their craft work in September and exhibit their craft work and show how they did, like potting or ceramics work of some kind, or knitting or weaving and so on. So we had these demonstrations and also a showing of the wares that were going to be available for Christmas. And we had, all kinds of different programs, and the programs have gone up steadily, so that since the first year to now, the amount of programming that goes on in the library and the attendance at these programs has gone up approximately 500%. So that would have been impossible had we stayed in the other library. And the building, as I say, the other building was crowded when we had 18 or 20 people in it. And that was a busy day. 18 or 20 people are completely lost in this building. There's seldom that few people in it. We don't even begin to notice the crowd until there's 45 or 50 in it. Circulation has gone up by 50% since we moved in here. And not only has that gone up, we did a survey in 1977 that did a lot of things, but amongst the things, this was done with the Library Research Center over at the University of Illinois, and with the help of the Friends also. But we found out that our in-building use of materials was nearly equal to our circulation outside the building. This is amazing. And no other library, there were other libraries participating in that study, and no other library came remotely close to the in-building use. And that is directly attributable to the cheerful surroundings, the open, the look, the agreeable staff, the general ambience of this building. It would never have been possible in the other building. I think that I should here say that the architects who did the remodeling did a remarkably good job at color coordination and maintaining the openness of the library and making it warm and inviting. I think they did just a beautiful job.
Mr. Duma, what were your hopes for the library when you first came here?
Well, there were a whole constellation of things that I wanted to do, part of which were based upon a number of things which the board, the search committee of the board, had specifically enumerated as part of their what they wanted done. They said they wanted the confidence in the library restored. They wanted the there was a drastic decline in circulation over the past 2 or 3 years. They would like to see this reversed. They'd like a new building, and they would like to see staff morale improve. When I shortly after I came, that formed in a hard core of what I wanted to do in the short term in terms of finite objectives. But there were other things that I wanted to do in the way of a general service program, an ambience that would be reflected in the library. Shortly after I came, the Friends of the Library had a dinner to welcome me. And at that dinner, I said my aim in as a city librarian would be not to create a temple of beauty or a temple of truth or any great idealistic edifice or have great idealistic and beauteous things in my mind. These were very good to have, and I would not ignore those aspects that contribute to the spiritual and aesthetic life of the community. But I did not think that a public library should have aesthetics and spiritual things as its primary goal. It required from the community good financial support, and it owed to the community to pay back this financial support by also contributing to the economic life of the community. And this is what I would hope to do, is to make the library a practical force in the life of every person in the community.
And has it worked out?
Well,
your estimation.
We've made strides toward it. That was my goal, and I think that we've made strides. It's something that will not ever stop, of course. That's a goal that you don't ever reach the way you do, say, a new building. You always work towards it. And I think we've made significant strides. We have increased the circulation. And what's more to the point is where the circulation has increased. There was a great decline from 1964 to 1973. There was a great decline in the use of the library by school-age patrons of the library. This partly resulted from, I think, the growth in school libraries under Title II at that time, so that students were able to get what they needed for school, and frequently for recreational reading as well, at the school libraries. More convenient, and the schools served them well, and so there was a decline of 40% in our patronage by school-age patrons. And at time, I was wondering whether children's services, for example, would continue to be viable. Since then, children's circulation has been growing in the library very significantly. But at that time, it hadn't, and yet our circulation was going up, which means that circulation decline was largely a result that the library had been experiencing, was largely a result of the growth of school libraries. And by reversing it, we were now serving the adult community in a way that they hadn't been served before, because our circulation almost immediately started showing an increase, especially in the central library. I was looking over the long term of where the circulation was growing. And you look at this periodically because of the techniques of books, collection maintenance, which we introduced here. I've always regarded libraries, as I said at that dinner that the friends had, libraries to have at their heart a need to merchandise material. It's a merchandising operation. And that means you've got to have something that people want, and you've got to know what people want. And in line with this notion, we early on, as I had in previous libraries, looked at where the circulation was coming from, or where it was growing, and trying to gauge the circulation to see if the circulation was a proper function of the size of the collection. That is, we were looking at turnover, as you would in a store. And we found out that turnover was very high in certain areas. Primarily, the turnover was greatest in the 600s, which include such things as books on how to raise your children, gardening, books on home economics, on how to repair your house, fix your car, books on how to cook, dressmaking, repairing of clothing, things of this sort. And this was this showed the greatest turnover of any collection in the library. So I said, well, let's build it up. And the more I built it up, the more the circulation increased. The turnover would not go down. And we've been working on that ever since, as well as some others. Now, there's in the 300s, there's a category of material, 330s, that deal with such things as investments and savings, estate planning, and real estate, managing your house or selling your house, buying a house. Now, these two have shown an enormous increase over the years, and we've built the collections, and the turnover rate of this material stays very high. So by looking at what was going out in the library and trying to adjust the collections to reflect the circulation, we kept feeding the more and more, meeting the practical demands, as I suspected we would, of the people of Decatur. And so this has been very true that over the years we have contributed, I think, in a very practical way to the meeting the concerns, the immediate concerns, raising children, improving your home life, gardening, things of this sort. We've not neglected, however, those aesthetic and spiritual elements, because every section of the library's collection, every section without exception, has shown an increase in circulation. So that I think that we're doing something all the way along to make the library meaningful across a full spectrum of library services. Now, I would also like to say that there's out there are people. It's not only the collections being used, but you have the question of who's using the collections? Who? Are we just servicing a narrow section of the community more and more? Last year, I set out to see if we could find that out. Now, when we computerized our circulation, which is really a milestone in improving the efficiency of the circulation department, when we computerized it in 1977, we introduced a capacity for charting the circulation in much more refined segments than before, and at the same time we were able to get a better handle on who was using the library. We divided the patronage of the library into male and female, into white collar, blue collar, housewife, retired, and with the children into male and female and their school age. We took the city and we divided the city into various, into the four postal zones, and like 621 was a large one, so we divided it in south of the river, north of the river, and Muffley area, South Shores, Muffley, and this side of the river. And that was the largest postal zone. So we got those three and the other postal zones standing alone. So we can determine what parts of the city people come from. So I took the April circulation as a sample, and I charted the circulation over years, just in April, and I charted it by male and female, then I charted it by occupational status, and then I charted it also by geographical location of the patrons. That is how many books were went out to people in these various areas. And I found that without exception, well, with one exception, I'm sorry, that our circulation and service had increased in every single one of these categories, every single one of them except one, and that is the circulation to people in the downtown area. And the downtown area, by and large, has been shrinking in its residential abilities over that seven-year period, so that accounts for that. But except for the downtown residences, our circulation has increased in every single area of every occupational category, both sexes, and in every geographical location of the city except for that one.
Well, you certainly should be congratulated. I think it's an amazing story. And anyone just walking into the library can be impressed, or has to be impressed, by the number of people who are here, the variety of people. Just by looking at them, you can see, as you say, that they come from many different backgrounds and people that one might ordinarily think might not be readers or might not be at home in a library. I think you've done a really amazing job of pulling people into the library, people of all different walks of life and various ages, and I and certainly different interests.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. L. I must say, however, you know, you say I've done it, but I told the board when I first come here they had to raise the salaries because I couldn't run the library by myself. And that's just as true today as it was then. So much of what has been accomplished has not been a personal accomplishment. Running even a small library involves a great many people. And what's been done here, and I think a lot has been done, but it's not myself who has done it. There's been contributions by me, I hope, of course, but also by the staff, most certainly, and by the friends of the library, by the board, by colleagues in the city departments, by colleagues over in Rolling Prairie, and so on. So it's been an enormous contributions have been made by a great many people to the improvement of service. And people of Decatur, I think, owe a great debt of gratitude to a great many people, not to me.
I realize that. I think that we certainly couldn't have an enterprise this big and varied without a great deal of help. But of course, it has to have leadership. And I'm sure that the city of Decatur congratulates itself on the leadership that you've got.
Thank you very much.
And we certainly will miss you. And do you have any idea of your own personal plans for the future?
Well, I tell everybody I'm going to sleep for a couple of weeks. Then I'm going out and see the desert in bloom. It's something I've wanted to see for years, and it comes at a time when I'm busiest here in the library. And we'll go on to California and visit my wife's folks, and I'm planning on taking a 6 week or 2 months vacation in Europe. And then in the fall, possibly we'll join the Peace Corps.
Oh, you really are ambitious.
Yeah.
Of course, your training here has encouraged you to look for fields like that, but might be a little more rugged even then.
Well, it might be, but it seems like a worthwhile thing to be doing.
Well, we certainly wish you well in all your enterprises.
Yeah, thank you.
There's one question that I've always wanted to ask you ever since I learned your name. Are you a descendant of Alexander Dumas, who wrote the Three Musketeers?
I tell everybody he was my son, but no, I don't think that there's any relationship. I don't really know the dates. I've never really been into the pursuit of genealogical matters or anything like that. My great grandfather, I do know, was born in Quebec. In 1847, so I think that the dates are a little wrong for any connection to be with the novelist.
Well, maybe when you're on your trip to Europe, you can look into
I can look into that.
Some of the Dumas family over there. Well, thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us and reviewing the history of the library, which really mirrors the history of Decatur in many ways.
It does in many ways, right.
We thank you for not only your contribution today in sharing your experiences here, but for the contribution that you have made over these 20 years that you have spent here.
Thank you very much, Mr.
And we appreciate it very much. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Robert H. Dumas, City Librarian, and this is Betty Jurnell.